The World Series battle between the Yankees and the Phillies may seem tame compared to a battle brewing in Los Angeles, a far more personal battle. Frank and Jamie McCourt, the married couple who own the Dodgers, are heading for divorce. As NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports, their split is worrying Dodgers fans.
Tom Bergen's Irish Pub has been in Los Angeles more than two decades longer than the Dodgers have, and is filled with many long-suffering fans who these days are wondering what's next. If the McCourts really do split, what happens to the team? The Dodger faithful are pondering the many ugly possibilities, says bar manager Philip Fox.
I know they're a little worried because, you know, whenever parents get a divorce, you always wonder what's going to happen to the children. You know, in this case, it's our Dodgers.
The team is an expensive asset and could be sold to meet the obligations of a divorce settlement. Frank and Jamie McCourt have been married for more than 30 years. They now live in California, where community property laws apply. But that doesn't necessarily mean things will be divided straight down the middle, says Stephen Mindell, a top L.A. divorce lawyer.
So in the case of, like, the Dodgers, the very first thing that'll have to be determined is whether or not the asset is community property. And if it's community property, then accordingly the judge will have to decide what is half.
Mindell says there are several things that could occur next.
One person may be bought out. The other person would then get to run the team. Or it could be that they have joint management of the team.
That's highly unlikely since Frank McCourt fired his wife from her CEO position 2 weeks ago. T.J. Simers, a sports columnist for the Los Angeles Times, says he's skeptical about how Jamie McCourt even got that job.
She had a nice husband who gave her the title, which I wondered about a couple years ago. What did he do, roll over one night and say, geez, I think you ought to be CEO?
But in court filings, Jamie McCourt says she is the public face of the Dodgers. Plus, she says, she's worked hard to increase the numbers of women who attend games, noting that women make up 40% of the Dodgers fans. Those fans might be a little anxious because they saw how a similar case played out last year when the San Diego Padres were sold so owner John Moores could settle up with his now ex-wife, Becky.
John Moores is going to get his money, and San Diego got a fourth-place team.
Associated Press sports writer Bernie Wilson says the Padres' payroll was slashed and star players like pitcher Jake Peavy were traded to save money. Club owners didn't hike the ticket prices, but Wilson says the Moores divorce took a big toll on the Padres.
Fans are not happy to be essentially paying major league prices for a minor league team.
Wilson says Padres' attendance has dipped as fans declined to pay the same price for a now lackluster lineup.
I know a lot of Padre fans who are still Padre fans, but they're no longer season ticket holders because they realize it's just not a good value.
Stephen Mindell, the divorce attorney, says don't expect a decision on who really owns the Dodgers anytime soon. The bitter wrangling over the team has just begun and will probably go on for a good long while.
My best estimate would be somewhere between 24 and 36 months before we hear the end of this story.
Which, for loyal fans, gives an entirely different meaning to the term Dodger Blue. Back at Tom Bergen's pub, some are still grieving over the Dodgers' failure to make it into the series. But that's nothing compared to the curveball of a nasty, expensive divorce battle, says Dorothy Kozak.
Historically, the fans out here have been so loyal to the Dodgers through thick and thin and earthquakes and fires. So I think it would be really sad.
Cheer up, Dorothy. Things may yet turn out okay. As Yankee great Yogi Berra liked to say, it ain't over till it's over. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
As you know, the days are getting shorter and darker and colder. It's the time of year when winter begins to creep in, and also the time of year when we look for things to make us feel a little more warm and comfortable. One of the best ways to do that is through a little dose of self-indulgence. The food writer and Morning Edition regular Nigella Lawson has some thoughts about self-indulgence. She joins us from London to talk about them. Hi, Nigella.
Hello. I'm very, very pro-self-indulgence. I'll be up front now.
I had a feeling you might be, although we should emphasize that in the United States, self-indulgence, I mean, kind of got that Puritan heritage over here, it's considered bad.
It is considered bad, and in a way you could say that only heightens the pleasure. So your negativity is not entirely negative, we should say. I mean, I think that we feel that self-indulgence is bad for two reasons. I think one, that people are kind of diet obsessed, and the other, of course, as you say, it's a puritanical feeling that somehow if you enjoy yourself, there must be some moral slackness.
Well, let's just dive into some moral slackness here, if we might. Because once again, our colleague, Courtney Dorning, has baked one of your recipes here. And just at first glance, it looks like a cross between a pancake and a toasted cheese sandwich. I believe it's called donut French toast. What is it?
Okay, that's fine. It's the right sort of color.
Oh, my God.
Really,
it's amazing.
It's
Excuse
really...
Excuse me. This is just amazing. It's like a donut, but it's French toast. But go on, go on. Please,
yeah,
please.
No, well, I think the reason why I think of it as a sort of donut is because the egginess and the vanilla come through, and
yes,
then you put sugar on top like a donut. And there's something, I don't know whether this is true, but someone once said to me that vanillin, which is the thing that makes vanilla smell like it does, is present in breast milk.
Oh.
So we have some very primitive desire to be comforted by the taste of vanilla. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm just telling you. So you could say it's a kind of Freudian self-indulgence.
I had a mouthful of it when you were saying that. It's really more than I needed to know. But thank you anyway. I appreciate it. It does taste like it's got almost like a donut glaze on it. It really is quite a treat. It's really great.
Well, sugar, you know, sugar is enormously comforting. And I say that as someone who finds all food comforting, including savory foods.
So how do you find a balance, or do you even try, between enjoying something a little rich from time to time and actually, you know, going overboard and being unhealthy?
Well, I think the balance is much easier to maintain if you don't deny yourself all the time. I think people who forbid themselves to eat anything that's been fried or that has butter are the ones that suddenly manage to eat tubs and tubs of ice cream.
Mm.
Whereas I think the body is self-regulating. There are times when you want something fried and then you feel like a very light soup or a plate of steamed vegetables. I mean, I actually feel I eat very healthily. My only problem is I eat enough for five healthy people. That's
oh, come on.
It's a portion control issue. But I do think it is okay to eat foods that the dietitians say don't eat. I also think that one should make a real distinction between self-indulgent foods that are real foods and processed foods which have all sorts of things in them which aren't good for you. So as long as you're cooking proper food for yourself, I don't think you need to feel so bad about it.
Oh, that's interesting. It sounds a little like Michael Pollan, who's been in this program many times, talking
yes.
about, you know, something that feels natural, something that your grandmother would recognize as a food rather than a yeah. food product of some kind.
No, I think he's quite right there.
Now, you've also got, if you don't mind, I'm going to eat the other piece of this donut French toast.
Carry on, crunching.
And as I do that, yes, it does have a crunch to it. It's really really crispy. It's great. I wonder if you could describe another recipe you've got here. I don't know if this would go with a donut French toast, but if you would describe the cheddar cheese risotto, please.
I would be delighted to. I don't think it does go with it, but I think it has a lot in common, even though, of course, the ingredients are very, very different, which is, I suppose, self-indulgent foods are reminiscent of the tastes we loved in childhood. So just like the eggs and the milk and the sugar in the donut French toast, the cheese risotto, the cheese melts and becomes sort of gooey. So I suppose it's like a slightly grown-up grilled cheese sandwich, but there's something about carbohydrate, which you cannot beat carbohydrate for comfort. And even though I at first felt, I felt bad about, you know, the Italians, and why am I putting cheddar mm-hmm. in a risotto? But an Italian friend of mine says that whenever she goes back to Italy, they ask her to bring cheddar back because, of course, for them, they make a choice between cheese that has a flavour or cheese that goes gooey. Now, cheddar has a strong flavour and also goes gooey, so it's kind of perfect.
Mm, but not something that would be on a traditional Italian plate.
Oh, not at all. But I think that my notion of self-indulgence perhaps isn't entirely the same as everyone else's. And what I love about this dish is you can sneak a few minutes in the kitchen and just stir. And sometimes I find that the best way to switch off. So I'm really in my own little world stirring something and then I'm eating it. I do think also anything that can be eaten out of a bowl with a spoon is a fantastic self-indulgence. No cutting, no chewing.
There you go.
Excuse me, I was just chewing some more of the donut French toast there. Is there anything to avoid when you're putting together some self-indulgent food like this?
Well, I'm afraid there probably are things you should avoid, but I don't know that I know how to. I suppose you don't want to have them every day. You don't want it to be a pile-up. And also, I think sometimes people confuse comfort eating with misery. So there is no point in indulging yourself if you're going to persecute yourself at the same time. That is what you have to avoid.
What do you mean?
If you don't enjoy it because you think, I shouldn't be eating this, then don't. If you can wallow in the pleasure of every single mouthful, then you're doing something good. And then I think then somehow it's healthier. No, it's not healthier. It doesn't make any difference nutritionally. But I think the mind is important as well as the body.
Nigella Lawson, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Nigella Lawson is the author of several cookbooks, including most recently Nigella Christmas. And if you'd like to indulge yourself at home, both of these recipes are on our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. If you happen to speak Mandarin, you can email your friends in Chinese, you can read web articles in Chinese, but you can't type an entire web address or URL using Chinese characters, or Hindi characters, or Hebrew characters, or for that matter, in Arabic. That's because up to now, domain names, the information that follows the dot in the .com world, could only be written in the standard A to Z or Latin alphabet. Well, that's about to change. ICANN, the international organization that oversees internet domain names, has approved the use of characters beyond the Latin alphabet in those domain names. The system is expected to go into effect in the middle of next year. Rod Beckstrom is ICANN's president and CEO, and he joins me now to talk about what's in a name. And Mr. Beckstrom, in this case, I take this as much more than just a cosmetic name change.
It is. It's a major change. It got started back in 1996 when a researcher in Switzerland decided that he was tired of not being able to type German letters in for domain names. And so he decided to kick off an initiative to introduce international domain names into the Internet 13 years ago today.
It sounds like this really could be quite a sweeping change because we're talking about a lot of people in some fairly large countries that might all be changing their URLs all at once.
Over half the 1.6 billion users of the Internet today are born in a language group that does not use Latin scripts. So for them, this is a very, very big deal because they've had to type in their keyboard in their native script, for example, in a word processor or something else, and then switch modes to type a domain name, which is really quite an inconvenience.
Okay, a couple points of order. The change right now only affects domain names and initially the new naming system will only affect web addresses that have those so-called country codes. So let's say that you're a business person in China. What would that new address look like?
The Chinese Latinate extension is .cn, which is the country code for China. So they'll be replacing that with some Chinese characters, or rather having a new domain name set that you can sign up for. Now, in the future, there'll be other top-level domains opened up in other languages, .com, .net. .org. But if you're a business in China, then you might decide to go and register your Chinese name dot the two Chinese characters when that becomes available sometime next year.
Just curious, in Arabic, will the URL be written from right to left?
And I'm actually not sure. I've got to look into that in terms of how they're going to organize the top-level piece. I would guess they might do that from right to left, because that would be natural for the eye.
Well, we're going to let you get back to us on that one. What about security concerns? We've heard suggestions that the more domain names that you have out there, the easier it might be for cyber criminals to take advantage of the system.
Yes. You know, one of the reasons it's taken so long to work this through the policy system is that there's been a desire to reduce the opportunities for cybercrime, in particular what's called phishing, which is when users are fooled by a domain name, for example, that appears in their email or appears in a link somewhere. Standards have been developed to avoid this type of problem. First off, of course, we're only going to approve the top-level domains like the, you know, .cn or .rf for Russian Federation, etc., that don't confuse users. And then there's some guidelines for what we call the second level that have been developed to avoid many of these problems.
What does this mean for people in the U.S. who might want to access a URL using characters that are outside of the Latin alphabet but don't have those characters represented on their keyboards?
Sure. Well, there's a couple of different options. One is, Michelle, about half of the pages people go to now, they get to through their search engines. So you might be able to search for a page using your English language or some names that you know, might get you to a link that's actually in an international domain name. If you're going to type it into your browser, you're either going to have to know how to switch your keyboard mode into a different language set or script set, or you're going to need to learn Punycode. But I think very few people will do this because, generally speaking, if you want to use a different language, you're going to be familiar with that language and how to flip your keyboard, you know, into that mode if you wish.
Rod Beckstrom, thanks so much. It's been good to talk to you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Rod Beckstrom is the CEO and president of ICANN. That's the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers.